Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Play Radio.
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 57 of Nerd Pride Radio. 57, yeah, I know you're expecting a bit on the 57th Overlanders, Captain Mal's unit during the Unification War, but no! 57 is also the number of millions of dollars that pro golfer John Daly claims that he has lost during his gambling career. Come on, John, 57? Always bet on black. So ask me how I'm doing today. Ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I am awesome! My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd, plus there's probably like seven other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You are listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my brain anymore. Nerd Pride Radio is brought to you by the words wicked and awesome. All right, what do we got? Updates! All right. First, a weight update. Since I've been doing it every week, I figure why not keep it up. I've lost another 5 pounds since last week, so I'm at 262. I know that seems a little extreme. I'm going a little fast, but this rapid weight loss, trust me, it is going to level out in about a week or two, and then I'll be down to just losing a pound or two a week if I lose anything at all. I've done this before. I know my patterns. The trick is riding this out until I've lost, you know, wherever I plateau at, 40 pounds, 50 usually. I mean, that's really right about how much I lose. And then seeing if I can maintain it after that. I wind up plateauing for a long time, and then something happens, and I ruin it for Thanksgiving or for some big celebration, a wedding that we go to. And then after that, it's like, you know what? I'm all right for a while. And then next thing I know, I'm 20 pounds heavier, 30, 50. So, you know. But I'll keep you posted, whether you care or not. Also, Snake. I told you last time that I'm playing Snake on my phone, old classic Snake, and I have now, I thought, after I did the report on it last time, I thought, yeah, I'm just going to get bored of this soon, and apparently I'm not. I'm still only playing, like twice a day, and my goal now is I want to play the perfect game. I want to play the bit where you find the little windy pattern that fills the board perfectly, and you grow until that pattern you've now filled the entire board, and then you die, because, well, you have to at that point. I'm about a third of the way there. I can fill up about a third of the screen consistently, and then I always wind up doing something stupid, because the pattern is kind of, especially the stupid controller I'm using here, if I was just on a regular keyboard on the computer, I could probably do it a little bit easier, but I'm getting there. This is my goal, perfect Snake. I'll let you know when I achieve it, because it's got to happen eventually, right? All right. But enough of that. It's time for the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, which is actually on my Pocket Mod now. I stopped keeping it on the computer entirely, all Pocket Mod for my master list. It works better because I'm keeping track of stuff while I'm out doing things. The Pocket Mod is always right there. I can just jot notes down at any point. And here comes my son. I'm not even done with the intro yet. Hold on. Hey, Jake, how are you?
Hi.
All right, he's awesome. It was easier than just transferring it over to the spreadsheet or the master list that I had. I had a Word document, and then I had a spreadsheet, and then whatever. Now I'm just working straight off the Pocket Mod. And so the best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. Before we check out the master list, though, since Jake is home, I'm actually recording quarter to two on a Friday. I took the afternoon off because tonight we are driving to Kansas City to go to the Renaissance Festival. And so therefore, I've got about 2 hours before my wife and the other kids get home from school. So I planned this out so that I would make sure I get everything packed that we need, get blah, 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 we're all lined up. And now I've got 2 hours to record for you guys. So I'm hoping I get to post this up tonight. We'll see if there's decent Wi-Fi in the hotel room. And if there's not, then, you know, you guys will get it Sunday morning, whatever works. But anyway, I'll record for a while. We'll see how this goes. First thing on my master list, it's the Science Corner.
Ooh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
That's right. That music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. Today, the Anthropic Principle. All right. I don't know how long I'm going to go on about this. It really half-formed. I should just warn you guys that the theme this week, again, completely unprepared. I literally picked, I have my master list in my my pocket mod is, I probably got like a dozen, 15 items on it. I picked out like five or six, kind of worked them how I wanted them, and arranged them like 2 hours ago. I mean, I hadn't even looked at them, hadn't thought about them, nothing. Because most of this week has been spent working on the Podomatic, and I'll get to that when I get to the Podomatic. But the Anthropic Principle is the idea that when you get to a point in science where you start wondering, okay, yeah, but why did the universe turn out this way and not some other way? All right. For example, the first time I heard this was when I was in, I don't know, ninth grade, and I read Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time, and he was talking about, well, why are we in a three-dimensional universe instead of a two-dimensional one? And nowadays they're asking, okay, well, why is the mass of these subatomic particles this instead of this? What caused that? Why are things the way they are? And the Anthropic Principle states that, well, they're the way they are because if they were any other way, we wouldn't be here to ask the question. That things had to be, certain things had to be this way in order for intelligent life to be able to develop and thus to be able to ask the questions. And I bring it up because it's come up a lot recently in physics. They are getting to a point with, and I am well-educated on these topics, which means I know almost nothing, okay? I'm a well-educated amateur, which means I barely understand what I'm about to talk about. So take this all with a grain of salt. But as I understand it, we've gotten to a point where superstring theory, string theory, supersymmetry theory, whatever they're working to unify physics with now, the stuff that you might hear Sheldon talk about on Big Bang, this stuff has gotten to a point where it explains a lot, but there are certain points missing, certain points that we're like, okay, but then, you know, if we've got these equations and this is how the world works, well, you could have picked any arbitrary value for this constant. And I know I'm not being really specific, but for example, the mass or charge of a specific particle or whatever, why is it the way it is? And we're getting to the point where we don't know. We come up with no real answer that explains it. The math doesn't choose one way or another. You come up with your best theory, you come up with your best equations, and at the end of the day, really, you could have filled in all sorts of stuff there. I mean, if you filled in this, it would have changed a whole lot of things down the line, but, you know, it would still work with a different set of numbers using the same equations. So why is it the ones we have? And it's getting to the point where a lot of scientists are starting to say, well, because this is the only way that we could possibly have people here to ask why. They're resorting to the Anthropic Principle. And a lot of people don't like that. They feel it's a little lazy. They feel it's a little bit of a cop-out. I completely agree with them. Because it also pushes for the multiverse theory. The idea that, well, okay, but if this is the only way that we could be here to ask questions, then why, how, what are the chances that it just by random coincidence, everything just happened to end up exactly here? Why did the universe land on the one possible setting of the dial that allows people to be here to ask questions? And to which scientists are saying, okay, that does seem like a lot of really random chance, and we don't want to rely on God. So tell you what, let's propose a multiverse in which everything that could happen did happen. And out of all of the infinite number of possible universes, this is the only one in which we have people around asking questions. So it must be, it gives credence to the idea of a multiverse, because if anything could happen, then we just happen to be in the one where intelligent life can develop. And again, there's no, this science doesn't really like the multiverse theory much, because you can't test it. If it's true, then by its nature, there's no way for us to visit any of these other universes. There's no way for us to detect any sign that they actually exist. We would just have to believe that, well, they must exist, because otherwise we wouldn't be here. And that, an unprovable or an undisprovable theory is one that is really, really tough to swallow when you're a scientist. We like stuff that we can test and verify or disprove or something, and we don't have that yet. And so I think what we're going to see, and I'm probably going to do this segment again in 2 or 3 weeks, because I'm going to do some research and actually look into stuff instead of just giving you half-remembered stuff from everything I've read over the last few years. But we have some serious signs out there that, A, maybe some of our long-held constants are not as constant as we thought they were. For example, the Planck length, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, certain real basics of science that are just absolutely constant. We've got some signs that maybe in other parts of the universe, they're not the same as they are here. And again, I wish I had that article at hand. I looked for it this morning because I was actually going to read up on it again. I've read it twice, and it still makes very little sense to me. And now I can't find where I put it. So I'm going to look for that, and I'll get back to you guys on it. But also, there's some new stuff coming up where people are finally, you know, the Large Hadron Collider did a lot of this, where we said, okay, if supersymmetry is correct, then we should be able to find these particles, that for all the particles we know, there should be these other particles out there that we should be able to find once we have high enough energies. And we found the Higgs boson, for example, and people were thrilled to death about that. Then there's like, you know, another dozen or 20 that we wish we could find, and they're just not turning up, ever. And at this point, we're going, okay, well, maybe we've just missed them. Maybe we just need a bigger collider. I don't know, but they should be here. And so people are thinking that, okay, we haven't really proven they don't exist, but the evidence isn't there to support them, so maybe we need to do something different. And there's some new theories out there that are wildly exciting and wildly different, but it's getting to the point where, you know, if we're going to keep believing in the stuff we've got and keep trying to develop these current theories, then we've got to start relying more on the anthropic principle. We've got to start relying more on just faith in a multiverse. And I think we're going to see over the next 5, 10, 20 years a real massive sea change in how people are thinking about physics and what our leading theories are. And you know, 30 years from now, textbooks in college will teach string theory as okay, well, you know, first we had the Greeks and they believed this stupid stuff, and then we got a little more advanced, we believed this stupid stuff, and well, then we got to string theory, which was a really good approximation, but oh, it didn't quite cut it. But then we moved on to, and that's where the wonder's going to happen. I'm excited for it. There's just so much going on. It's just really amazing. And again, I wish I had actually done a little research. I wish I had more specifics to give you guys. I'm just saying, I'm excited about physics right now. And so I'm going to do some research, and I'm going to revisit this topic eventually. I just don't know when. But I'm excited, and you guys will be there with me when it happens. So this is going to be super cool. That's all I got. All right. Next. Okay. More music. Don't know much about history. That's right. It's the unnamed history segment. Yay. All right. Here's the deal. So I wrote down for my history segment, missile silos. And because have I told you guys the missile silo story, my own personal missile silo story yet? I don't think I have. It's been on my list forever. I keep wanting to tell this story. I've been thinking of writing in my own Podomatic entry, and I would even email it to myself just so I could ask myself to tell about the Missile Silo story. But you know what? I'm just going to tell it here. And I was going to then go look up a bunch of stuff about missile silos and give you some history stuff that goes with it, because this is the Unnamed History segment. But instead, you're just going to hear a story from 1978, which is historical. Damn it. Especially, half of you weren't even born in 1978, so you'll enjoy this. And it's my own personal encounter with a missile silo. Because I know, by the way, there's tons of abandoned missile silos in this country. Some of them, I think, have been filled in. Some of them are, a lot of them are privately owned and have been renovated to a degree. Some of them are just on private property and just sitting there waiting for someone to do something with them at some point. But here's the story of the missile silo I actually went to. This was in 1978. And if I've told this story on the podcast before, I am really sorry. You guys are going to hear it again because I love this story. This was in 1978, and my dad was in the Air Force. God, now, you know what? I'm telling it, and I feel like I've told this before. I feel like I've told it on the podcast. Doesn't make any difference. I'll tell it again. My dad was in the Air Force, and him and a couple of his buddies, I don't know where they heard about it. I don't know what happened. They heard that there was a missile silo that was open for just a short bit, and there was access to it, and there was a big strip mine right next to the thing, and it was, I don't know if it was being sold off or, you know, if it had been decommissioned and the military was finally getting rid of it. I have no idea. All I know is that me and my little brother and my dad and his two friends and all of their kids, we all took this big, long road trip. We drove for, to me, it seemed like 3 hours. I have no idea how long it took us to get there. I was eight, for goodness sake. And we got to this strip mine out in the middle of nowhere. And we get out of the car in this kind of dirt parking lot thing. And we go walking over. And hanging out over the strip mine is literally a door. A door that is hanging over the edge of the strip mine. It's like out, like, 4 or 5 feet from the edge of the mine. The mine is this big old pit going down into the ground. And 4 or 5 feet out over the edge, there's a door standing there in just midair, facing kind of sideways to us. And the door is connected to a stairwell that goes down underneath where we're standing. And the stairwell is completely surrounded by concrete. So it's just this concrete tube coming up at an angle with a door floating out in the middle of space. And so my dad and his buddies lay some boards out. They found lumber. I don't remember if we brought it ourselves or if they just found it at the site, but they laid some boards out from the solid edge where we were standing out to the step of this doorway. And we all crossed over and got in. It was phenomenal. It was unreal. It really, at the time, I remember it was bizarre, but looking back on it, it's even more so. I mean, it's just such a surreal image. It would make a really good visual in some sort of show, movie, whatever, just this door hanging there. And we go down, and for God's sake, we were inside a missile silo, which, by the way, is not just a big hole in the ground with a nuclear rocket in it. No, it's way more than that. There's like offices all over down there. There's these catacombs and these, to me as a child, it seemed like this wondrous underground maze dungeon thing. Maybe my fascination with dungeons and enclosed settings for my games, whether it's dungeons or an insane asylum or this fascination with underground hidden secret, I don't know. Maybe it stemmed from there. Maybe not. I don't know. But it was wondrous. It was just huge. Again, I'm eight. And we go down the steps, and we're in this series of offices, and offices that look like they had been abandoned in kind of a hurry. I mean, there's paperwork everywhere. Like mountains of paperwork just scattered in piles on the floor. And I mean, obviously someone else has been in there. They've kind of vandalized, torn up the place a little bit. You're seeing stuff just laying everywhere. I don't know what was on the paperwork. I was eight. I didn't bother to pick it up and look. But I can only imagine that, I mean, this was a nuclear missile silo. And and there's file cabinets laying open and all this paper and all this junk. The desks looked like it still had their office supplies still in it and were just dumped out on the floor. Like the last day that they used this thing, they kind of expected that the movers would come back and clean up for them, and no one ever did. It was bizarre. Absolutely bizarre. And it was really super cool. And so we keep wandering around, and I don't know if they knew where they were going or if we were just looking to see how far we can get. I have no idea. But eventually we got to a vault door, a blast door, a giant. Like if you're on a space station or if you're in a bunker, if you're in a war situation and someone tells you to seal the blast doors, this is the door you're sealing. The thing was huge. It like an 8-foot circle, this huge steel door. And when the door was kind of swung open just enough for us to wedge our way through it, and I swear to God, the door was minimum 3 foot thick, maybe four. It was one of those. It was huge, the biggest thing I'd ever seen in terms of doors. I didn't have a whole lot of experience with doors at the time, but you get my picture. And so we went through until we found the actual silo itself, all right? And if you leaned out, because we got out on this little railing, that apparently there's a fire escape, a catwalk, inside the missile silo itself. Like, there's no missile, obviously, that's been decommissioned, it's been moved. So we're looking at an empty missile silo, and this catwalk goes around, like, exactly out of a science fiction movie or political spy action thriller thing, that if you were in a missile silo, in the actual pit itself, this is what you would want to see. You would want to see catwalks and stairs and you know, bars of metal sticking out for no good reason that people can swing from and climb down and do all sorts of wild action stuff. This was exactly designed for it. And it was dark. We're looking up, and where we were, I would guess, accounting for size, hold on, train, stupid train. So here we are looking up, and I'm guessing we were 5 stories underground. Maybe more than that. I don't remember. More than that. But it was a long way up, and that's how far we had gone downstairs and wound around stuff and down more stairs. And so I'm looking up. We're standing on this metal catwalk that, again, has some stairs that lead down and then some ladders like the world's worst fire escape, and I don't know where you're escaping to in a missile silo, because it only went down. And we're looking up, and you can see the doors. I was about to call them blast doors. I don't know what they're called. The hatch, the thing, these big rectangular monster doors. All right, just two of them that clearly opened up drawbridge style, and just opened up to let the missile out when the time came. And so we're looking up at those doors, and one of them is completely shut, and the other one is like propped open, like just enough that there's some sunlight coming in. So we actually have some light in here, but not much. So, I mean, you couldn't have asked for better atmospherics. God, I have got to run a game in a missile silo at some point. I have to. I didn't even realize until I'm telling this story how perfect this would be for a game setting. Oh, I'm doing this. And so we're looking up, a little sunlight. There's those giant, giant doors. We're in a honest-to-God missile silo. I mean, the thing was huge. We're looking all the way around the cylinder on the inside. And we go down the metal stairs. So we're down on the next level now. And now, oh, look, if we go beyond this, the railings kind of give out. There's no more railings, and now it's kind of ladders. And now, you know what, kids, why don't you guys stay back in this doorway? And the stupid adults, because, I mean, our dads couldn't have been 30 years old at the time. I mean, that's probably how old they were, and they were having a great time. I mean, this was really for them, and they brought the kids along because, God, you're never going to get another chance to see this in your life. You have to be here for it. But really, this was for them. This was them playing. I would love to have been able to do something like this as an adult the way they did, because it was wonderful. And so they go down. You know, they have one dude, I think it was Joey's dad, and stayed with us. And then my dad and this other dude head down as far as they can get. And then my dad waits, and the other guy starts climbing down a ladder that really shouldn't have been climbed down. All right. And he goes down further, and we can't see him anymore. We're looking down into the darkness. We cannot see him at all. But we can hear my dad and him yelling back and forth to each other until finally my dad says, he says there's ice. That's right. This was middle of the summer. It had to be July or August because we weren't in school, and it had to be July or August. And in the middle of summer, at the bottom of a missile silo, apparently there's ice because the door's open, weather's been getting in, they've got, you know, a pool of standing water down at the bottom, and it's frozen in July. And I wished I could have seen it. Oh, we begged to be able to go down a little further, just to be able to see. Come on, we get. I mean, but even with the flashlights, we weren't getting anything from where we were. And then that was it. I mean, they reported that there was ice. They found the bottom. They knew what they were looking at. And I don't know. I don't believe he actually went all the way to the bottom, but he went far enough down that he could see that, yeah, it was frozen over. And that was not something you wanted to fall into, I'm guessing. And then we left. Packed up and went. And I know there's still missile silos that obviously are active today because we've got more than enough ordnance to blow everything off the map several times over. Got that. But there's also a lot of these abandoned ones around. I would love to have another chance to do something like this because there are places that, you know, you could buy one. You know, you got $6 million laying around. You could buy somebody's, you know, little patch of land with a missile silo on it. They come up for sale every once in a long while. It would be perfect for a villain's lair. I've already told you the atmospherics are awesome if you want to be a Bond villain. Holy crap, it is exactly where you want to be. And so I would love, yeah, and I've thought every now and then that I should look up and because online there's got to be, this is where the research would have come in today if I'd been paying attention, there's got to be people out there who have a missile silo on their property. They've renovated it just enough to make sure it's safe. And I'm sure there are people who give tours, people who, or maybe if they don't give official tours, maybe there's people that, you know, if you slip them a few bucks, they'd let you go in for a little bit, you know, at your own risk. Sure, go ahead. It would be fun. I would love to go back. So it's a little piece of history that I actually got to put my feet into. And it was really cool, dudes. Seriously. And girls. Dudes is a non-gender specific term. Don't get offended. All right. Enough of history. It's time to visit my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, then I am here to share it with you. And I didn't know if I wanted to put this in the history segment or in the gaming segment, but since we already had a history going on, I decided to put it into gaming. The book is Designers and Dragons, written by Shannon Appleklein. It is a history of the tabletop role-playing game industry, and it's fascinating so far. It is being published by Evil Hat, written by Shannon Appleklein. There is a Kickstarter for it, and I am way too lazy to put a link to the Kickstarter in the show notes, but I'll put something on the forums because I've already put the link out there or somebody put the link out there. Maybe it was Jeff because Jeff is the one who brought it up first and said, if you're interested in history, check this out. But I don't think he named it in the thread title. So I'll go out and put out a thread that has the proper name on it. And Designers and Dragons has a link in it. Go to the Kickstarter. It's worth your money. Right now, the first book is already written. It is the gaming RPG history of the 70s, looking at the companies that sprang up then and the people behind them and how things went during the 70s, during the beginnings of the role-playing game industry. And then the next three books are, you know, 80s, 90s, and the aughts, and they are still being written, thus the Kickstarter. And so if you go in, I think if you want all four books, the minimum donation on Kickstarter is $15. $15 for all four of those books in PDF format. It's really, really a good deal. And then, you know, if you want to go higher than that, you want to get hardcover versions or bound versions of these. I don't even know if they're hardcover necessarily. But if you want print versions of these books, then there's other levels where you can, for example, you can get, you know, PDFs of all of them, but you'll get a print version of one or a print version of two or all the way up to the big the full price donation where you can get everything mailed to wherever you'd like. And I'm excited about it. Because the 70s is already written, your donation to Kickstarter, it's not a donation really, but your contribution to Kickstarter automatically gets you access to the 70s in PDF format immediately, and I did that right away. I'm only a little bit into it, but I'm already hooked. I am just hooked. It is because it's a history of it's a history of RPGs. I you know I love games. You know I love RPGs. You know how much I love role playing. I love it so much that I have a podcast just so I can talk about my role playing every week. That's how much I love role playing games. And I've been playing them for 30 something years, and I'm still playing, and I still love them. And to see this history written at a time where most of the principal people are still alive, that you can get a history firsthand from people, interviews with people who were there for every step of this. You know, you're getting information directly from the people who were involved in it, or in the cases of some like Gygax who have passed on, you know, people who knew him personally, worked with him, worked for him, did, you know, this is I don't know, it's very immediate for me, and I'm really enjoying it, and I cannot wait to get through, because, you know, the 80s in the heyday of role-playing, when it first really became, I mean, role-playing's never been mainstream, but close enough. The 90s is where you finally start seeing more of it in pop culture. The revolution of Dungeons and Dragons 3rd edition and the open gaming license, and I can't wait. I'm really, really looking forward to this. And so I wanted to bring it up here because I want you guys to contribute as well. I think the Kickstarter already has, I think they've got enough to be fully funded, but I don't know for sure. It doesn't matter. Get in on it just because you want to enjoy it. Get in on it just so you can have that first PDF right now and start reading the 70s like I've been doing. This is going to be great. I am really, really looking forward to this. So, and plus, you know, I'm not familiar with Shannon Applecline prior to this. He's got gaming blogs online. He's worked in the tech industry, worked in the gaming industry. He's written a bunch of different stuff. I just did some looking at him a couple days ago. And he seems interesting, but I've not been familiar with him before now. Well, I'm starting to check his stuff out. He seems to know what he's doing, and it's published by Evil Hat, and so you know you can trust Evil Hat, right? Really, get in there, give some money. It is worth your time. You really want to do this. Also at my gaming table, I'm not going to delve into it yet because, again, lack of research. I don't have any fully formed thoughts, but on the forums, nerdprideradio.com/forums, there's been a lot of character talk lately, developing characters and role-playing characters and what works for different people and how we go about it. And it's just fascinating. It's gotten to the point where, for the first time ever, and I don't know how long it's going to last, but for the first time ever, the gaming portions of our boards have been way more active than any other section of the boards, which is normally unusual, normally that is an unusual thing. Yeah, I said that correctly, just awkwardly. Because normally it's just, you know, you go into the main sections and you just sit and chit-chat about any topic, whatever, and then the gaming stuff is always just kind of a sideline. And every now and then something pops up, but it's not often. And now we've kind of reversed that. The main forum, the Nerds Talking About Stuff forum, it's not a whole lot of traffic there. But the gaming ones, it's been nice. It's been a lot of fun. So come check out the boards. Come read up with us. And like I say, there's some really interesting stuff to take away from those conversations that I will probably bring back to the podcast at a future date. But right now, I just wanted to let you guys know that, hey, if ever you were interested in joining the boards, got some good stuff going on, come join us. Hang out. Let's see. Oh, and also on the gaming table, and this is part of that same discussion. I'll bring it back later. I made a list of every character I've ever played. I've made millions of characters, and I've handled millions of characters as a game master. And okay, millions is wrong, but certainly hundreds, if not, you know, a few thousand. And I've only played a handful of times, actually been a real player who's made a character, gotten into a game, and actually had a chance to role play something for any length of time. It just doesn't happen often. So my full list of every character I've ever played, 10 characters. Wow. And it was interesting to look at, because I tend to make some generalizations about, oh, well, when I make a character, or, oh, when I role play, well, you know, my experience on the actual role playing side is kind of minimal. I mean, looking at it now, it puts some stuff into perspective for me, but I'll come back to that another time. Come join us on the forums. Enjoy the conversation, and even if you don't come join us, don't worry about it. I'll report back later. You know I can't stop talking about Pathfinder. So, I'll be back. But afterwards, get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, Rrr!
That's right. It's yet another nerd rage. Okay. This is going to seem stupid. I don't care. Ziploc omelets. Have you ever made a Ziploc omelet? Oh, they're the best. Let me give you the directions for this. And while I'm talking, if you come up with an objection to my methodology for cooking, don't worry, I'm going to address that. For Ziploc omelets, we learned it as a scout camping recipe, but now we just make it at home on a regular basis. We do Ziploc omelets a lot. And you take a Ziploc omelet or, you know, whatever your generic brand is, but you have to get the freezer bags. You get Ziploc bags, and they have to be freezer bags. They have to have the zip seal on them, and they have to be the 1-quart size. Have to get freezer bags. If you just use the regular storage bags, they're going to be too thin. Trust me on this. But you get the quart size. Has to be the quart size. And then into that, or then put your name on the outside, by the way, because there's going to be lots of people making their own omelets. And so everyone needs to have their name on the outside, because otherwise you're going to lose track of who's the who's. Okay. Now, you've got your labeled bag. You crack 2 eggs into that sucker. And then, I don't know, whatever you want to make an omelet out of. I mean, ours is usually ham, bacon, cheese, mushrooms, tomatoes, onions, peppers, spices, whatever you want to put in. Doesn't make any difference. But you throw in whatever ingredients you want for your particular 2-egg omelet, then seal the bag up. Get out as much air as you possibly can and seal the bag, and then just mush the ingredients until they're all mixed up nice and thorough. Perfect. Good job. Now, get a big old stock pot of boiling water going on the stove, and once it's boiling, throw all your omelets in the pot. Don't overfill it. Make sure they've got a little bit of room to shuffle around, so if you need to do it in 2 batches, do that. But throw all your Ziploc bags into the boiling water, and then wait 15 minutes. That's it. You boil them for 15 minutes, and when you are done, you will open that bag, and out will roll a perfectly formed omelet. Tasty as all get out. They are awesome. I love Ziploc omelets. They're easy. They're fun because the kids, you get all the ingredients chopped up and ready and setting out in bowls on the table, and everybody comes through and just picks out whatever they want. So everyone gets to customize their own omelet to their own taste, and then you boil them, you enjoy them. That's all there is to it. It's awesome. Also put hash browns in them. That's pretty good too. If you can cook up some, if you've got the time to cook up some really good crispy hash browns ahead of time, and you can have those ready to mix in, because all the other ingredients, really, you pull them out of the fridge, you dice them up, and you just lay them out in bowls, and they're ready to go. The hash browns you kind of have to work at, so we don't always do those, but they're wonderful. Now, where's the rage, Mike? Okay, I'm getting tired of every time I tell someone about my Ziploc omelets and how much I enjoy my Ziploc omelets, and I share this recipe with anybody and everybody, I invariably get one person that says, oh, yeah, I don't think cooking in plastic like that is safe. I've heard that the plastic leaches into your food, and it can be toxic. Hold on a second. Sorry about that, and she's going to call back in 5 minutes. I just know it, but we'll keep going anyway. People always complain to me that they, you know what, I don't think that's safe. And so I tried bringing these up for our last Cub Scout camp that we were going to go on, where the Weeblos were all going to go camping. It wound up getting rained out. We didn't go anyway. But we were planning food ahead of time, and I said, hey, here's an easy one. Let's just bring along a big old pot and some Ziploc bags. Kids can make their own omelets. It'll be awesome. And then one of the parents poo-pooed me and said, oh, no, that's dangerous. You can't cook in Ziploc bags. That's going to be blah, 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 whatever. All right. So I'm getting tired of hearing this, because we just had Ziploc omelets 2-3 nights ago, and we made up some extras so that we'd have them to take to work for lunches. They were wonderful. I enjoyed mine. It was awesome. My wife, however, didn't enjoy hers so much because as she's trying to eat it, and everyone's like, oh, wow, what do you have there? And she explains what she has, and then she has to get one of those. Yeah, well, no, isn't that poisonous? Isn't that going to be bad? Oh, I would never do that. That's, oh, my God, making her feel stupid for feeding this food to her kids. And so my wife, my poor wife, did not get to enjoy her omelet nearly as much as I enjoyed mine. And so I've done my research on it, and guess what? You people are wrong, all right? You are completely and totally wrong. Because, and here's the deal, and here's where the confusion comes in. So I get that there is some basis for what they're saying, but there are two types of plastic wraps and plastic bags, two main types that you're going to find in your home. And one is bags that are made of polyethylene. Those are perfectly safe to use. Polyethylene does not leach into your food. There's nothing wrong with it. And virtually every name brand bag and name brand plastic wrap that's out there is made of polyethylene and therefore perfectly safe. In fact, if it says on the package, most of them will say microwave safe or instructions for using in microwave or whatever. If it says microwave safe, especially, you know for sure that you're good. But for the most part, all the name brand stuff, Ziploc, Glad, whatever companies make bags, all of those, perfectly fine for use in food. That's why they make the freezer bags, the microwavable bags. That's why they do it. It's safe. It can be done. All right. On the other hand, there are bags that are made, and especially plastic wraps, that are made usually in large bulk for storage and other purposes, to be sold to catering companies and other places that kind of want the cheaper materials. And those are made with PVC. And when you make it with PVC, yeah, PVC is perfectly fine to store food in unless you're going to cook it under heat. Then, yes, PVC containers start to leach into the food. And that's where they had the problem with certain storage containers that were being made for food years ago, that we found out that if you microwaved your food in your plastic storage container, then you would wind up possibly poisoning people. So they changed. So now all those Tupperware-style plastic containers that they sell for home, all of your storage bags and plastic wraps for home use, all of them are now made of polyethylene. Therefore, they're fine. Quit worrying about it. Stop being crazy. And quit telling me that I'm doing something wrong because you're driving me crazy, all right? I don't know. I guess I kind of overconfidently just muscled along all this time just thinking that, you know, hey, I know it's safe. I'm going to be fine. But I never actually checked. Well, guess what? I checked. And now I'm right. That's the end of my rage. You know what that brings us to? Do you? That's right. It's time for the Pod-O-Matic. Heck yeah. Hot dog. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod. Oh, wait. You know what I didn't do last week? Holy blueberries. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do those topics come from, you ask? Well, that's where you come in. Hold on, it broke over a page. Ah, you want to hear me haver on about something? Send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. All right, I told you earlier that I spent a lot of time on the Pod-O-Matic this week. You guys are going to have to forgive me because it's probably going to be a little slow this time. What I discovered was that because of my computer crash and restoring from backup and then getting people who gave me some extra submissions, I had some stuff that never did get deleted, and so I had extras in there that we've already done. I had a ton of duplicates in there. There was just a lot of extra stuff in the Pod-O-Matic list. So I spent a long time this week just cleaning those out, trying to get it down to where I don't have any duplicates left. I think all the ones we've covered in the past are already removed, and just generally cleaned up. So the Pod-O-Matic list is in much better shape now, and I've also reformatted it. So it's got a different layout, maybe harder for me to find stuff. We'll see if it actually works. Hopefully this makes it easier. But you never know. And at the same time, because I love to change more than one thing at a time, I've updated R2 himself. The Pod-O-Matic bubble, up to this point, has always had, in my little Pod-O-Matic bubble, there he is, in addition to R2 inside the little bubble, there's all I've got the percentile dice in there, and it's always been the tens die, if that's what you call it. The tens die had was a mustard color. It was kind of mustardy and black with the numbers on it. And the ones column, the die 10 itself, was in a kind of a navy with really stark white letters on it. And it was really visible, and I really liked it for that. But it was really a plain, kind of boring kind of die. And it has always bothered me. I mean, 3.5 years, 3 years now, that they just didn't match. And it's been bugging me. So this week I updated the Potomatic list, and I kept thinking about the Potomatic. I kept thinking about R2. I've been worried about R2 dying, but you know, I found out he just takes AAA batteries, which I've never had to change or replace. But, you know, it's just AAAs. I can buy a replacement R2 if I ever need to. But it's been bugging me with those mismatched dice. So I opened them up again, and I put in two new percentile dice that they're still not quite matching. They're not from the same set, because the problem is all the matching percentile dice we have all belong in somebody's set, and nobody wants to break up their set. So, but I have a whole bunch of mismatched dice that I've bought in the big old pound of dice deals when I go to Gen Con and stuff like that. And so I found two green ones that are fairly close to each other, and they look good together. And so that's what I'm using, is a new green set. So I've got a new look, but I'm now wondering if I'm so used to looking at the colors that I always just look mustard than navy. You know, it's always yellow than blue, and I know what I'm looking for. I might get a little mixed up now. What I'd really like, I'm sorry, I know he's got a number there waiting. We could do this at any moment, but what I'd really like is next year when I go to Gen Con, I'm going to buy some dice, because I always buy dice at Gen Con. Love buying dice. I could literally bathe in a bucket of dice, a big old pool of dice. I would be thrilled. That would make me so happy. Like Scrooge McDuck diving into his big pool of money. Yeah, that's exactly what this would be like for me, and I'd be so happy. But what I want is I'm going to shop specifically at Gen Con next year for a set of dice, percentile dice, that match R2. Something in his blue and white that hopefully, like, with a little texture to it, like a speckled or a marbled. But something in blue and white that matches R2 looks good in here. I mean, the green ones are nice, but, you know, green is not really R2's color. But we'll see what we can get. In the meantime, again, that's my long-winded apology for why this might not be as fluid as it normally is. And now we'll see what we're doing. Okay, the first number is 15, and 15 is from... Ooh, it's from Kyle. Hey, Kyle. See, here's the new system already. All right, there we go. Highlight. Kyle says, when are you too old to sleep in bunk beds? When you're too old to climb up into them is about it. I mean, I know the question you're asking, but we just went on vacation to the Black Hills, to Custer State Park. I told you about that. And while we were in Custer State Park, we got the bunkhouse, which literally four big sets of bunk beds all across one wall. And it was awesome. And of course, now, me and the wife being older, we took bottom bunks and the kids all took top bunks. So I guess there's an age thing that limits you there, that at some point you're just like, yeah, you know what? Sleeping up that high off the ground is just no longer a thrill. I'll be fine down here. But we slept in bunk beds, just on the bottom bunk, and it was fine. And I suppose, you know, if you're on a submarine, you could sleep in bunk beds at any age, right? That's how they rack them up in submarines, is you put them all in bunks on the wall or on the naval ships or on the whatever. That's how they do it. So, you know, bunk beds are all cool. Now, to actually have a bunk bed in your room as your regular bed for sleeping? When you move out of your parents' house. No, because we did it in college too. So I don't know. Yeah, once you're not in school anymore, I'm gonna say 20, 21 even. Yeah, then you get a little too old for bunk beds. Not that it still wouldn't be appropriate. I mean, I can see being in a position where you've got a really small place and you're sleeping in a lofted bed, which is not really a bunk bed, but, you know, it's like the top half of a bunk bed. You're sleeping in a lofted bed, so you still have the room underneath. I can see there are lots of possibilities. So, I don't know. I don't think you're ever too old to sleep in a bunk bed, but yeah, at some point, you know, you really, yeah, Yeah, I'm going to 2021 to answer your question for when are you going to regularly sleep in a bunk bed? Probably that age. But then I hate to set a hard line because I'm sure there's plenty of people out there who are perfectly normal, well-adjusted, wonderful people who have slept in bunk beds much longer than that and had really good reason to do it, and it wasn't awkward for them, and it was no big deal. And so, therefore, who am I to judge? Right? Right. Any age is fine for a bunk bed. What do I care? All right. 26, says R2. 26 is from... It's from Kyle again. Good work, Kyle. Way to work it, man. 26. See, now I lost it. Stupid system. I may just go back to the original. We'll see. Kyle says, how much did you pay for the shoes you're wearing, and how old are they? Oh, God. The shoes I'm wearing right now are a pair of Skechers sandals, and they are probably the third summer I wore them. Maybe it's just the second summer I've worn them. So probably two, just a little over 2 years old is my guess. And these Skechers sandals are my absolute favorite sandals that I've ever worn. They're those kind of sandals that have a lot of foot cover. So they've got, I mean, really just a few little diamonds of openings in between the big old straps. And so it's one of those where after you spend a day camping or at the beach or wherever it is that you're going to go, you wind up taking your shoes off and you've got really white feet with just these little tan diamonds all over the tops of your feet from the sandals. But I love these. I love these shoes. They're awesome, awesome. This is, how much did I pay for them? I think 25, I think. But I don't remember. It's a couple years ago. I usually pay around $30 for a pair of shoes. But, you know, sandals are a little different. I don't know. 20, 25, could have been 30. I have no idea. Something like that. 95 is all the way down at the bottom of the list, and this is from, let's see, there it is, Zimny. Would you rather be able to read minds, fly, or become a dragon? Oh my. I'm going to go with dragon. Holy crap, how awesome is dragon? Are you kidding with me? Oh, I mean, yeah, okay, reading minds, I actually don't think I want to read minds. I would love to be able to read minds for a day, and then that's it. And even then, I don't really want. No, you know what? I don't want to be able to read minds because I will tell you that everybody in the world has stuff in their head that they would rather you didn't know about, and I don't think I could deal with it. It's something that, yeah, eventually, I mean, if everyone was telepathic or if lots of people were telepathic, if there was some basis of experience for this and, you know, reading minds was something that you were kind of used to and you could, you know, we'd all get to the point where we all realize, oh, we all have thoughts like that. Oh, yeah, oh, it always, okay, I know, I get it, it's fine, it's cool, but for just a short period or even God, for, yeah, no, I wouldn't want to read minds at all because even if it was temporary, once you've read someone's mind, you can't unknow that. I suppose it would be kind of cool to have that ability if I didn't use it on anybody I really know well. If I just went out in public and I just randomly read some strangers and kind of learned what I could learn and went, wow, they're a bunch of freaks. Oh my God, who would have guessed that? Oh, that's really, but I wouldn't want to know the secrets of the people around me. This is, I think I've said this before, but probably on a mind reading question, in fact. But once upon a time, when computers first entered my workplace in a big way, I knew more about computers than anyone else in the building, even though my job was not computer guy at that time. It is now. And what I found out was that my boss left his files open and unprotected, and I could go in and read all of his correspondence. And I could flip through and see, you know, the spreadsheets he's working on and the stuff that I could go look at anything I wanted. And I thought, oh my God, that is amazing. And I went in and I looked, and it turns out that there wasn't anything worthwhile to look at. For the most part, it's pretty dull. And part of me is like, okay, one, this isn't exciting because I'm sure there's really, really cool, bizarre stuff in there that I you know, someone's disciplinary report or someone's whatever, that there could have been stuff like that, but you have to wade through so much garbage to get to it, so much mundane stuff to get to the good things, that, yeah, it was way too much work for me. And two, I realized that, okay, what am I looking for? Juicy tidbits of gossip? You know what? If I ever actually found anything like that, it would probably freak me out, because at that point, once I know it, I can't unknow it, and I can't use it, because then they'll want to know how I knew. It's just, no, that's just not pleasant at all. I'd rather not know. So, same thing with mind reading. I don't want to do that. Flying would always be awesome, but you know what? If I turn into a dragon, I can already fly. No, I'm definitely going dragon on this one, dude. Number is 31. 31 is from Zimny again. Go Zim. And Zim says, what weaknesses should a vampire have in a game? All right, this is the sister question to the werewolf question last week. All right, vampire weaknesses now. Vampires should be vulnerable to sunlight. They should not sparkle. Hell with you. They should be vulnerable to sunlight, absolutely. And the rest of them, repelled by garlic. I can see an aversion to garlic. All right, cool. If you want to work that in, you could make that one sensible, I suppose. Repelled by holy symbols, again, I've seen that. And only the ones I like is when the holy symbol is backed up with someone's real faith. And it is the, because if you're gonna work in vampires, then yeah, having as some sort of evil undead that have true, you know, demonic powers or wherever their power originally comes from, then having true faith, real belief on the other side, the holy power of God or whatever you believe in, to counter that makes sense. But again, a holy symbol only if it's backed up with truth faith. I mean, the guy who just, like Benny from, I say Benny as if you're just going to know right off, Benny from The Mummy. I love Benny. He's awesome. And when The Mummy first accosts Benny in the tombs, he starts rifling through holy symbols on his neck, holding them up one at a time and saying the appropriate prayers for each one, which has no effect on a mummy because it's a mummy, not a vampire, stupid. And second of all, he had no faith behind any of them, so even if it had been a vampire, and even if vampires really were vulnerable to holy symbols, Benny's trick would not have done anything because Benny didn't believe in anything, and so therefore he had no faith to back up his symbol. So yeah, holy symbols, if backed up by faith, that could work. Sunlight, garlic, I don't care about. And otherwise, what, can't enter a place unless invited? Come on. I don't know. Stake through the heart? That's still, I mean, it's so traditional. You got to go with it, right? You have to go with stake through the heart. I'd like a little more justification for it. I mean, does it have to be wood? I mean, does just putting it through their heart, what was the movie? What was the movie when he drives a stake through the vampire's heart and then the vampire just gets right back up and comes at him? And the guy's like, well, what? And the vampire says, yeah, Formica, go figure. But that's about it. I don't really, I go with the traditional ones. I mean, really. And they should have weaknesses. Again, screw you, Twilight. Seriously, they should have weaknesses. But again, in Twilight, they weren't villains. Anyway, they were, some of them were, but in general, they were just a bunch of Mary Sues. So it doesn't really matter for Twilight. But in general, if you're going to use vampires, no. They have to drink blood to survive. That's pretty much the given, because otherwise you're not a vampire, are you? That'd about do it. Nice. 39. Oh, we're already right there. Hey, this one's from Ronster. Ronster says, if you had an alignment, what would it be? Lawful good. I already know that one. I know who I am. And I would like to think that I'm neutral good, but I know that I really like the rule of law. I really like order. I really like that things are fair and that people do what they're supposed to do for the betterment of the greater good. I like that. But, it's so hard to classify directly because, I love my First Amendment rights. I love my Fourth Amendment rights. I love I like the Bill of Rights. The first 10 amendments to the Constitution are spectacular if you're a U.S. citizen. I'm sorry for the rest of you who aren't. I'm not sorry that you're not a U.S. citizen, but, you know, maybe this doesn't relate to you as much. But my freedom of speech, my freedom of religion, my right to freely assemble, as much as those rights are being completely infringed upon in this nation right now, and have been for decades, and it's just getting worse. I don't mean to get political, sorry. But I like those freedoms and that sort of libertarian urge that I have when it comes to my first my Bill of Rights. That urge feels very chaotic good in that, or chaotic neutral even, in that, you know, everyone should be free to do whatever they want as long as it's not hurting someone else. And I'm really big on that. But part of it is that, yeah, I know, but those freedoms are encoded in law. So there's my lawful part, is yes, that I have actually kind of really the best of both worlds. In an ideal world, in an ideal space, where we actually still had all of the freedoms listed in the Constitution and still could exercise them the way that they were intended, the way that they ought to be, according to my definition of stuff, in that perfect world, we would have that chaotic good freedom to do whatever we want, but we would be able to have that because it is encoded in law, because it is protected. And there's my lawful good. I'm sorry. That's just who I am. Lawful good. And you'll notice in all of this, the good isn't even a question. I believe in happiness and joy and love. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm going to name it the Love Cast. That's right. I heard you. So, I believe in all those things, and I believe in spreading positivity and joy and goodness, and that's why I do what I do. And so the good part wasn't even a question for me. But the law chaos thing, I'm fascinated by that dichotomy. I'm fascinated by the arguments that go with it. I love, no matter how stupid you think alignments are in Dungeons & Dragons and in Pathfinder, and I know lots of people hate them, and they think they're stupid, and they've been partially phased out, and you know what? I love the lawful chaotic dichotomy, and I love the good evil. I love alignments because I like kind of fitting a character to some of those traits. And I know it's kind of nonsensical, kind of stupid. It kind of leads to some real awkward D&D situations, and there's ways to get around that. But I love playing with all that stuff. But yeah, for me, lawful good. All right, R2, 75. 75 says, it is from Zimny again. Oh, you are winning today, Zim. And Zimny says, what is the worst weather you've ever experienced? Having a tornado come over while at scout camp. We were not the scout camp in this area. They got wiped out by the tornado and had 4 people die. That was the camp 50, 60 miles over from where we were. But a couple of years after that incident, there had been the scouts that died at Little Sioux, I think was the name of the camp. There were scouts that died at Little Sioux and because of a tornado. And then here we are 2 years later at our own week-long scout camp, and tornadoes came through. And it was really frightening because the weather was horrifying, and it was, it was buckets and buckets of rain, terrible winds, the skies looked terrible, and everyone's hiding. We fortunately were standing at the, we were near the cafeteria building, the food hall, food service hall, what a dining hall, there you go, that's the words I'm looking for. We were near the dining hall when it happened, and so we just moved into the basement storeroom thing at the dining hall, and it was packed. I mean, we were wall-to-wall people in there. There was no room to move. And they kept bringing water in and passing it around, but it was sweltering hot in there. It was particularly scary for 2 reasons. One, I mean, it was really, really bad weather. Some of the worst weather I've ever seen, but it was having all those kids there, all those scouts there. I mean, the kids are all 11 to 15 years old. There's also a lot of adults, but we're responsible for these kids. And that was kind of scary. And more than that, is at the same time, my family, who was another 70, 80 miles away, was under a tornado watch themselves, and they were in the basement, sitting under the stairs in the basement, waiting for the tornado to pass over. And so I'm on the phone with my wife whenever we could get reception. We would talk for just a little bit. And so here I am with my son at scout camp, hiding from a tornado, and he's getting sick to his stomach and not feeling well because of the sweltering heat and the nerves and the all this stuff going on. And then my wife is sitting underneath the stairs with the third son, who's throwing up into a bucket because storms just push him over the edge. And it was frightening. It was terrible. And we didn't have the worst of it because there were other scouts at that camp that if you were in your camp at the time and you weren't near any of the buildings, you weren't near any of the facilities, if you were actually in your camp, which some of them were a good ways away from all the other stuff, you were supposed to lay down underneath the wooden platforms that all the tents were mounted on, which are all mostly on hills. So you're laying underneath a platform with your tent above you, waiting for a storm to pass over. And again, they're mostly on hills, so as these floodwaters are coming down, you're laying under a wooden platform, listening to the storm, waiting for things to pass over, and water is pouring down over you. I mean, everything's turned into mud, and water is just cascading over you while you're hiding there, and you can't do anything about it. There was nowhere to go, nothing to do. Those people had it way worse than I did. So that was pretty bad weather, but again, could have been a lot worse. 99. Wow. All the way to the bottom of the list. That is from Ronster again. This is a good one. Jane Cobb versus John McCain. Oh, dude. Seriously? That is an excellent matchup because I don't know. You know what? No, I do know. It's going to be John. It's going to be McCain because, wait, John McCain? McCain? All right, well, it's not McCain. I have my font too small. I wanted to be able to see everything. No, it's really McClain, just like it's supposed to be. God, I'm an idiot. Because if it was John McCain, Jane's going to wipe his ass all over the floor. He's an old man. What are you going to do? But no, John McClain, if it's Bruce Willis from Die Hard, then McClain's going to win. Because I didn't even realize I had made that error until the fourth time I said it. McClain will win over Cobb for the simple fact that John McClain's whole bit is to win out over the bad guys and specifically to take out goons. And as much as I love Jane, as much as I love Jane Cobb, he's a goon. That's what he's a hired goon. A glorious one, but he's also a screw-up. That's one of his things. I mean, yeah, he always wins out in the end, ultimately, but a lot of times, not intentionally so. McClane's going to take that one. Nice, 21. 21 is Stan. Stan says, what would be your favorite and least favorite forms of apocalypse? Let's see. My least favorite would be humanity being wiped out slowly by an exponentially increasing plague of insects. Oh, that would be creepy and horrible. Just imagine it. Oh. My favorite form of apocalypse would be one where because apocalypse means we've got to wipe out people, right? Do you have to wipe out stuff too? Because, okay, give me an apocalypse where aliens come down and abduct 95% of the population of the Earth at complete random for their scientific experiments or alien slave labor or whatever it is that aliens need to abduct human beings for. And they just bodily beam them all off of Earth and they're gone. And so now the Earth is decimated. Society is going to collapse because suddenly there's no one running the power plants and there's no one doing this. But all the people who are remaining are no longer in any real danger. We're all relatively unharmed. and we can set about rebuilding society at a fairly quick pace without any of those other people there to bother us. I mean, okay, yeah, sure, we'll have to figure out agriculture because eventually all the food's going to spoil and the canned goods can't last us forever. But, you know, we could figure stuff out. I think we could do it. I really do. Because all your other traditional apocalypses, seriously, are mostly pretty bad. You don't want to... I mean, okay, The Stand is pretty close on this one. The reason I went with Alien Abduction is, okay, The Stand is not bad as far as an apocalypse goes, because, okay, yes, you have to see lots of people die, and you know, your family's going to die, disappear, and that's going to happen with the Alien Abduction scenario, too, is you're going to lose people that you care about, and that sucks, but it's an apocalypse. Well, I mean, seriously, what do you want out of an apocalypse, right? But in The Stand, the difference between that and the Alien Abduction scenario is that in The Stand, everyone, you had to watch them slowly die of this terrible flu, watch it spread, and then you had all these bodies to deal with, and that's gruesome, grotesque, horrifying. Much, much, much cleaner to just have the aliens just beam them all away to be slaves. I mean, I'm sorry for them, and I wish, you know, it's going to be one of our primary goals once we rebuild civilization, is we are going to get ourselves into space and figure out how to go find those aliens and slaughter them so that we can free our people. I'm sure we will do that, but for right now, you know, hey, we've got this whole world to rebuild civilization in. So, oh, by the way, speaking of The Stand, oh, all right. I love the book The Stand, Stephen King book The Stand. It's about a bunch of people. Well, it's about a super flu that gets released. It kills, you know, 99% or like, oh, I think only 1 in 10,000 people survive, something like that. And it's this huge, massive magnum opus of a story, this epic tale that follows the lives of dozens and dozens of survivors and where everybody goes and how they all tie together. And it ultimately winds up being a big story of good versus evil. I mean, real heaven and hell type of stuff. And I enjoy the book. I mean, it's a bit wordy. It's a bit long-winded. It's Stephen King. But he's a gripping writer. And I enjoyed the book. I've read it twice. The movie? Not so much. The movie was really... kind of tiresome. Not nearly as good as the book. Not worth it. All right. This is just rumor. They're supposedly remaking The Stand to be released in 2015 or 2016, something like that. They're remaking it as a movie feature, a theater release movie. And again, this is just rumor. I've not looked it up. There's no verification of this, but apparently they're pursuing Matthew McConaughey as Randall Flagg, who was the big bad guy. And I'm not excited to see a new Stand movie. I've had my fill of The Stand. I'm done with it. I don't need another movie. But Matthew McConaughey as Randall Flagg? Oh, my God. All right, if you've read The Stand, if you've seen the original crappy movie, I am telling you, you could not pick a better Randall Flagg than Matthew McConaughey. Oh, I would go watch it. If Matthew McConaughey really is Randall Flagg, I will go watch that movie solely to see him play that role because it was made for him. This in a book that was written before Matthew McConaughey was even on the radar as a movie star. That role was written for Matthew McConaughey. He would be dead on perfect at that. I would watch the crap out of that movie. Oh, that's my favorite R2 noise. 13. We are up to the top of the list with Kyle. Hey, Kyle. Kyle says, what's your position on pushing friends around on empty mattress frames on a concrete floor? Pro or con? Oh, I love these from Kyle because he's asking me a question specifically so I will tell a story about him. When I was a kid, and so was he, I'm 2.5 years older than he is. Well, 2 years and 3 months. Whatever. We were, or 2 years and 9 months? 2 years and 9 months. It goes the other way. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. When we were kids, I was maybe 12 because we were in the house in Bellevue. No, that would have been, no. Where were we? We were in the house in Papillion. Yeah, we were in Papillion. That's right. So yeah, 12. So he would have been 9. And we had an old bed frame, a twin bed frame, down in the basement. It's nothing but literally metal frame, a wheel on each corner. That's all this thing is. And since it's on wheels, we thought, ooh, cool. Wouldn't it be great if we could ride on this thing and someone push you around on it? That would be awesome. So Kyle got on it, but unfortunately, well, he's only 9, and this bed frame is kind of wide for him. So, yeah, I mean, he got 1 foot on either side of this bed frame, so he's almost completely doing the splits riding this bed frame. And now, in order to keep his balance, the only way he's going to be able to keep his balance is if he leans way over forward and holds on to each side. So he's holding, he's got 1 foot on each rail and then one hand on each rail, so he's like doing a bear crawl, but he's just holding on for dear life. And when you push it, it does not go far because those little tiny caster wheels are not made for smooth rolling. They're just so that you can maneuver your bed around. They're not made for actual travel. So I give it a shove, and it lurches, stops. Kyle rocks right over onto his face. Bam! Face down on the cement. So, in answer to your question, con, it's bad. 48. This one comes from, let's see. Ooh, it's from Kyle again. Kyle says, do you watch Community? If not, why not? If so, right? Yeah, no kidding. Dude, Community rocks. And you know I watch Community. Now, you asked this question probably before I really got into it. But yes, I watch Community. I've seen first 2 seasons of it on DVD, and then it went into syndication, so I've been watching a lot of them in syndication. I'm kind of catching them out of order. I still mean to keep going back to the DVDs because I would like to continue it and actually watch everything, be completist about it, because I love Community. Oh, Community is awesome. Everybody should watch the show Community. It's great. And now he did 3 seasons, and then Dan Harmon, the creator of Community, who is also the creator and host of Harmontown, the podcast. Dan Harmon did 3 seasons, and then he got fired, and then the 4th season supposedly sucked. I don't know. I haven't watched to pay attention. Again, I got to watch them all in order and go, okay, this is season 4. This is what they're talking about. So I'll know which episodes they're talking about. But supposedly season 4 was not nearly as good. It wasn't able to maintain that same spirit. And then after season 4, they went, okay, instead of canceling it, how about if we get Dan back for season 5? All right, so they got Dan back for season 5, which went really well, supposedly, and then got canceled. And now it has been picked up by Yahoo. So season 6 of Community, which is, I think, being written and filmed right now, is going to be showing on Yahoo. And I don't know what kind of subscription that's going to involve, or if it's going to be ad-based, or if it's... I have no idea how it's going to run. I've never watched anything that's Yahoo-based. So, we'll see. But, yeah, I love Community, dude. Love it. Last one. All right, number 83. 83 is... it's from Zim. All right, we close on Zim. It says... oh, God, this is going to be a tough one, isn't it? Yidra the Dream Witch has challenged you to a cooking contest. You will both need to cook a 4-course meal... What do you make? Okay, does it matter that I'm competing against... bless you. Does it matter that I'm competing against Yidra the Dream Witch? I don't know who that is. But if I'm going to cook a 4-course meal, this is a tough question. Because these are things I need to think about. I love to cook. I love to cook, but I mostly cook real basic... real basic stuff. I like casseroles a lot. I like simple food. I don't do anything really fancy. I hate making sauces and gravies that require me to cook it at this temperature, constantly stirring until it starts to thicken, and then, oh, quick, add these things, and then blah, blah. I like stuff that I can mix and cook. You know what I mean? So a 4-course meal. What's even involved in a 4-course meal? We're talking appetizer, salad, main dish, dessert. Is that the 4 courses of a 4-course meal? I don't even know, because, boy, I got nothing on this. I'm going to lose this contest, because I don't do anything fancy. Because, I mean, seriously, for me, if I'm going to do appetizers, I'm going to do something simple, like meatballs. Like, when you go to a potluck, you always, the 2 things I always pray someone brings is, I hope someone brings a crock pot full of meatballs, in that nice creamy gravy. Or I hope that someone brings a crock pot full of little Smokies. Little Smokies, little sausages in barbecue sauce. Oh, God, if I get to a potluck and nobody has brought those, I'm always disappointed. But I am for sure going to bring the meatballs. And now, I'm not going to do a salad course. I will do a soup. And my soup will be Eli's favorite potato soup, which is my son Eli, when he was really little, we made this potato soup. It was a brand new recipe that someone had given us, and he loved it. He loved it so much, we named it after him. We customized it to our own tastes, and we've been making it ever since. I love Eli's favorite potato soup. The thing is awesome. For my main course, I am probably going to do Italian chicken, which is Italian chicken. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be so food-based this episode. This is going to be really dull, so I'll try and do it really quick. But my Italian chicken, literally little chicken strips that are dipped in Italian dressing and then coated with a breading made of mashed potato flakes and some other stuff, and then you bake it. And it's actually, they're really low-cal, really healthy, because you use light Italian dressing. And then they're tasty as all get out. Oh, perfectly spiced, wonderful, with these little breaded chicken strips. They're amazing. Let's see. And then to go with it, probably do just some real basic rice with vegetables in it. Something like, you know, rice with peas and carrots. We just had that last night, in fact. It was awesome. And then for dessert, oh, what do I do for dessert? I think I'm going to do, I don't know. All my desserts are just bars that we make. Like either pumpkin bars, which our pumpkin bars are awesome. It's like pumpkin pie, but with more of a cream cheesy kind of frosting on it instead of just Cool Whip. And it's really, really good. The pumpkin bars or possibly the cream cheese bars. It's layers of croissants with cream cheese in the middle, a little bit of cinnamon sugar on top. I'm going to go with the pumpkin bars, though. They're more impressive. They really, people try the pumpkin bars. They're like, oh my God, they're really good. So yeah, that'd be it. That's my four course meal. I should recap it, but I'm not gonna, cause that's the end of the Pot-O-Matic. So, at this point, I think this is where we bring in GLaDOS, isn't it?
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage, A Wonderful World by Sam Cooke, She Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner. All of these songs are available on iTunes. You check them out, you buy them, you enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes, write me a nice review, or you can check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop at the Facebook page, click like. It's just 9 seconds out of your day. You will not regret it. You can do that for a buddy, right? Let's see. Oh, or catch me on Twitter. I've got to add this to the credits. Catch me on Twitter, at Nerd Pride Radio. I love my Twitter. Check it every day. Still obsessive about it. Don't forget to check out my free games page. I have the free games. Oh, God darn it. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page. Instant Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to contact me, you can always drop me an email at mike@nerdprideradio.com, and I promise I'll actually respond to you. But to be totally honest, the best way, that's where I should really put in the Twitter, isn't it? Is after the email address. I should go email, then Twitter. But to be totally honest, the very best way to talk to me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we will hang out together, and we'll have fun. Sweet 37. 37 is from Zimney Pot again. which is the best sci-fi monster movie you've seen? I don't know. Sci-fi monster movies, I would probably say the original John Carpenter's The Thing. I love that movie. I already did it in the podcast. It's a great movie. It's a great monster. It's definitely sci-fi, and it holds up. It holds up over time. The practical effects out of that thing are amazing. And yeah, there's some of it that looks a little hokey now. Who cares? Whatever. It's still a good movie. I recommend it to anybody. Anybody and everybody. And in fact, they did the sequel to The Thing recently, and apparently they hired a special effects crew to do all practical effects. They weren't going to CGI it. They wanted in tribute to the original, they were going to keep it with practical effects. And so that's what they did. And they had all this stuff worked up. This company made all sorts of great stuff for it. And as it turns out, the producers looked it over afterwards and went, well, yeah, you know, this is great, but it looks all 80s and stuff. To which they said, yeah, that's the point. That's what they asked for. This is what we were looking for, is we wanted it to look like an 80s monster movie. This is what we were hoping for. And so ultimately, all that stuff was scrapped, and they went with a CGI thing for the sequel. And I think they suffered for it. I mean, it wasn't a bad movie, but it wasn't a great movie. I think they really should have gone with the originals. And so the people that did those effects, they had all this stuff that they made, and they wound up not being able to use. And so they've put it into their own new movie. They're putting together this new monster film that I believe it's called Harbinger Down. Harbinger is how I pronounce it. It could be Harbinger for all I know. I've never heard it spoken out loud. But Harbinger Down, where it's essentially The Thing, but on a boat. And I think it was Kickstarter funded. I don't remember. But anyway, I'm hoping this thing gets to a point where I get to actually watch it at some point. I don't care if it's streaming somewhere. I don't care if it's in the theaters. But the idea of getting to see what the remake of The Thing, or the prequel to The Thing, however you want to phrase it, to see what it was intended to be and to see those effects. And the people who have seen it or seen cuts of it say, yeah, it's clearly 80s style special effects, but that's what's wonderful about it. It's really cool. So I'm looking forward to that. I think it'd be kind of neat.